Thanks very much, Padma Dharka. It's a lovely day. The sun's shining. So, if someone was asked what is the most common, most popular Buddhist practice, I think they would probably say meditation. In the West, they'd probably say meditation. Buddhists meditate. That's probably the most abiding image, the Buddha seated in meditation, or the lone monk in retreat meditating. And very often when people talk these days, they talk about my practice, they talk about their practice, they mean sitting meditation. They often just mean sitting meditation. Some with a bit more experience might make mention that, well, you know, Buddhists seem to do a lot of chanting, a lot of puja, a lot of ritual. Both would be wrong to say that they're the most ubiquitous Buddhist practices. I think it's more true to say that the most widespread Buddhist practice in the traditional Buddhist East is generosity, giving, what's called dana. It's a very, very strong and very important Buddhist practice, and very underestimated in the West, I would say. And to think of meditation as my practice is far too narrow. To think of Buddhist practice as just meditation is far too narrow. And we probably won't get very far in our spiritual progress with holding that view. And thinking about images of the Buddha, in the East there are as many images of the Buddha, maybe even more, where he is standing or even walking. And when he's standing or walking, he's frequently in the gesture of giving. One kind of different kinds of giving. There's the open-handed Varada mudra, the mudra of supreme generosity. There's the mudra of giving fearlessness. There's the different mudras of giving the Dharma, turning the wheel of the Dharma. All these are images of generosity. And Buddhists in the East are very generous people. I've spent a bit of time among Buddhists in India and in Malaysia, and I'm very, very struck by their generosity. In India, it doesn't matter how poor they are, they really do practice generosity and hospitality and helpfulness and kindness. They're very, very good like that, and they go out of their way to be generous. And of course, this is the effect in part of being part of a traditional culture. Especially if you are a guest to their country or to their home. They're extraordinarily hospitable and generous. And especially if they hear you give a Dharma talk. And they're deeply moved by that very often. I notice this with very poor Indian Buddhists, their financial generosity. They hear a Dharma talk, they want to give something. So they'll come and give you a rupee or two or something like that. Something that expresses their appreciation. And it can be very humbling indeed to be on the end of this, on the end of this expression of deep appreciation. And it really is deep appreciation. It's not just some sort of habitual thing that they do. I can remember once giving a Dharma talk in a city in India, and it was a particularly good evening. I was on form. My translator, who is as important as me in giving a talk, was on very good form. And afterwards, there was a woman sitting at the front, not a wealthy woman by any means, who just put her hand in her blouse, put something into the hand of her child. And the child pointed to me, and the child came up and put several hundred rupees in front of me. And I was deeply shocked and deeply humbled. And you know, I went to my friends afterwards and said, is this right? And they said, do you think I should give it back? And he said, well, there's absolutely no question. That would be absurd. I mean, people would be very offended if you gave it back. And they said it's okay. This woman, she's not making herself very poor in doing this. But it's very, very humbling to see this kind of generosity. In the West, I sense that generosity as a spiritual practice isn't taken that seriously. We might get very concerned about our meditation. But how often do we seriously question our lack of generosity? Or whether, in fact, we are doing any spiritual training in that virtue at all? Perhaps we just don't realise what a powerful spiritual practice generosity is. Perhaps we don't have very positive associations with generosity and with giving. Maybe acts of charity for us, because of prior conditioning, maybe they're associated with feelings of guilt and with a feeling of sort of emotional barrenness and impoverishment. You know, sort of we give because we feel bad that we have what we have, and so, or maybe we're just plain stingy, or just unaware of the needs of other people. For Gampopa and Buddhist tradition generally, generosity is associated with wealth, with riches, with abundance. And this is how Gampopa begins his discussion of the perfection of generosity, which is the subject of chapter 12 of the Jewel Ornament of Liberation. Just before looking at that, I should just say that I want to say something about this word perfection, because we're concerned here with dana paramita, the perfection of generosity, and we're going to be looking at other virtues called paramitas or perfections. So originally the Sanskrit word paramita, let's look at this. Gampopa understands the etymology of this to be that which enables us to cross over to the other shore. That which enables us to cross over to the other shore. The other shore being enlightenment or nirvana. And Gampopa explains this in chapter 11, if you want the reference, where he gives a general introduction to these paramitas. So these are the practices that the Bodhisattva trains in, that he brings to perfection in order to lead himself and all beings to the other shore of enlightenment. So they are generosity, ethics, patience, effort, meditation, and wisdom. So the Bodhisattva trains in these completely and fully. He's constantly perfecting them. And Gampopa says you follow them in that order. You start with the basic and you move on to the more subtle, the deeper paramitas, as it were. Or we might say that if we're having difficulty with our sitting meditation, we need to look at the more elementary paramitas, and especially we need to go back to dana paramita, the perfection of generosity. So let's go to that now. And I said earlier that Gampopa, following general Buddhist tradition, associates generosity with wealth and abundance. In the very simple Buddhist sense, that if you're generous now, if you give now, no matter how small the gift, in the future you will enjoy wealth, you'll enjoy riches. It works the other way too. If we're mean and stingy, if we don't give, we become poor in the future. It's even said you end up as a hungry ghost, a praetor, a wraith-like figure who wanders the wastes in a state of perpetual unsatisfied craving, with an enormous belly and the mouth the size of a pin, and whatever he tries to eat or drink turns to fire or turns to excrement. Now, of course, the sophisticated and the cynical might smile and think, well, that's just the way these clever Buddhist monks devised to get people to give them things. It's all very primitive. But I think, actually, in this life, there is an observable truth here. I notice that generous people, not just people who are materially generous, but people with a generosity of spirit, have an abundance to them, whether or not they're materially wealthy. There's a richness to them and an expansiveness to them. And they don't lack for friends and people who look out for them. And I've seen people as well who are mean and stingy, self-preoccupied, and it doesn't matter how well off they are, material, they seem so poor of spirit. And they really do occupy that very grey landscape, that landscape of unfulfillment. Nothing is good enough. And they very often don't have many friends. People don't want to be with them, especially as they get older and they get into difficulties. So you can see this. I think this is an observable fact. And Gampopa underlines this by quoting an ancient Buddhist text that says, "He who is unaccustomed to giving gifts remains without wealth, is unable to attract people, to say nothing of his inability to attain enlightenment." If you are lonely, friendless, disconnected, well, maybe it's worth looking at the state of your generosity. Now, it could sound as if Gampopa and Buddhist tradition are encouraging a manipulative use of giving. You give to get friends. You give with strings attached. You give because you want something back. And we know how off-putting that can be. We know how there can be a sort of tyranny of someone's apparent generosity, and you feel sort of obliged to respond to them, because it isn't real generosity, of course. Don't worry about that, because later on Gampopa also talks about motivation. And one of the motives is that we give without attachment, we give without expectation, we give cleanly. The point Gampopa is making is just a fact. If you are genuinely generous, generous without strings, good things will come. You will enrich your life. Note too the quote that if you're not accustomed to being generous, you can forget about enlightenment. Doesn't matter how slick your ideas are, how brilliant you are in meditation, if you're not generous, you can forget it. Later, Gampopa quotes two texts, one which says, "It's not difficult for a generous man to attain enlightenment." And even more powerfully, "Generosity is a bodhisattva's enlightenment." So that's something to ponder. Generosity is a bodhisattva's enlightenment. So why is this? What's being got at here? Well, we need to remind ourselves of the nature of enlightenment, or if that's too far away, of any genuine spiritual attainment worthy of the name. In Buddhist tradition, attainment means seeing through the fiction of a fixed and separate self. That sounds like a very metaphysical thing, but what it means in actual experience and in expression is that we stop being selfish and self-centered. It means realizing a deep connection, interconnection between ourselves and others, and that finds expression in generosity, an opening out to others, a response to others. We're less attached to what we possess. There's less of a grip on things. You hear this word non-attachment in Buddhism. You'll come across it a lot. Now, this also can be misunderstood by us moderns. Non-attachment doesn't mean spacing out, yeah? It doesn't mean entering some cool, disconnected, neutral space like some sort of zombie stoner. That is not non-attachment. I'm sure everybody, some are laughing. They obviously know what being a zombie stoner means. It means that whatever you have and are, you want to give and share with others. That's non-attachment. You sort of know that in the end, nothing can really be yours. So you want everyone to benefit from what you have. So you share, you give. There's a wonderful quotation from Shantideva's Bodhicharyavatara, which Gampopa refers to a lot. I don't think he quotes it in another place in his text, where Shantideva's trying to talk about this, and he just says, Why say many things? Just notice the difference. The immature do things for themselves. The wise man gives happiness to others. Now, yesterday I spoke of the arising of the bodhicitta, this mind and heart focused on enlightenment for all beings. And when that actually arises, that's when the distinction between self and others begins to just start dissolving a little bit. It just starts getting attenuated a bit. So then the desire to give begins to flow. But what to give, and who to, and how? So Gampopa explores this in great detail. He really lays out the training in generosity, and I can only mention a few of the things that he refers to. So there's three broad areas of things to give. Material goods, things, fearlessness, and the Dharma. These are the three broad areas. So material things. So there's two aspects to this, the inner and the outer. The inner thing that you give is your own body, or parts of your body. But Gampopa, you will be relieved to know, says that this isn't advisable in the early stages of our career. He says, it's amazing that they put these things out, it's extraordinary, they sort of casually put them in. When a bodhisattva is still a novice, and so has not yet realised his ultimate sameness with others, he is apt to give up his whole body. I love that. He's apt to give up his whole body. So it's the bodhisattva is sort of a bit impulsive early on. So don't do this. Because, Gampopa says, the body is very important. It's very valuable. We need it. We need to use it for liberation. Perhaps we could look at this in our own terms of how we use our time and energy. Okay, we're not going to make some grand gesture of killing ourselves for somebody or something like that. How we use our time and energy. Making sure that we don't burn out. This is really important. Don't burn out of false compassion, which is often motivated by guilt. The bodhisattva is not a sprinter. He's not a sprinter martyr. He's very much a long distance runner. He's very, very much a long distance runner. So we need to give our time and energy to our practice and to others steadily and consistently, and ensuring that we maintain the conditions to support our body and our energy. So this is really very, very important. So that's the internal aspect of things. The outer aspect of things is giving things in our possession, giving money, giving food, giving clothing, whatever we have, we give those things to others. But of course, it must be appropriate. Gampopa says, you don't give things to people that will do them harm. You don't give alcohol to an alcoholic. And this is an interesting one for some of us. Rich foods to someone who is very greedy for food. Armaments to those who would do violence. And I think there are raises all sorts of interesting questions in our joined up world about the profits from our bankers go and all that sort of thing. Very interesting discussion. So who do you give to? And there are four main recipients mentioned. There's the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, spiritual friends. And we give to them because, you feel moved to give to them, even inspired to give to them. You're inspired by what they are and what they do. And of course, the three jewels and spiritual friends, the Sangha, they use that money, those resources, to practice and spread the Dharma. They need our material support because they have very little of it. I mentioned earlier how generous, very poor Indian Buddhists are. But they love to give because there's such gratitude to the gift of the Dharma. And so they also want to be involved in that Dharma activity. They want it to grow and thrive in their land, in their country. Many of them, they've even said, look, I can't be a teacher myself. I can't do that. I'm too old now to do that. But I really want to support you in what you do. Maybe they don't even have much time for meditation because some of them have to work extremely hard to support their families. And there's very little time for that. But they want to be with you. So they give. They're generous with what they have. So perhaps for ourselves, maybe it's a measure of how much we've been really touched by the Dharma. It's a measure, you know, in terms of, well, how much are we doing to support Dharma activities through giving and through money, through time, through energy, to support this activity. It's, by the way, I should stress, this isn't a question of ought and should. This is really important. But perhaps we could just do some reflection in this particular area. Secondly, the second group of people we particularly give to are those who've helped us, like mother and father and so on. Again, this is natural, really. We look at our life and we see those who've helped us from the beginning and right now. Okay, they haven't been perfect and they aren't perfect. They're far from perfect. But we take another look and we see, well, what have they actually given to us? They've actually given us a lot in so many ways. So there's a natural desire to reciprocate. I think this area of gratitude is, again, a very important emotion. It's not, again, something that is about should and ought, but the state of gratitude is a sign that egotism and selfishness is beginning to sort of dissolve, that there's a real wisdom in gratitude, because you start seeing just how much you receive from others. And as we saw in last week's talk, it's regarded as the basis of metta, when in according to Gampopa, when you reflect on what you've been given by others, loving kindness and indeed generosity starts to flow. Thirdly, the third group of people we give to are those in very obvious suffering, those who are sick. Gampopa mentions orphans, and of course he's talking in a society where there's no organised social security. It's all based on, you know, people responding to what they see. So sick, orphans, and so on. He's talking about people in very, very obvious need. So you give. And I just want to say something here about Dada Rinpoche, whose relics are in our stupa outside. And he's such a fascinating man, because Dada Rinpoche was one of the great scholars and yogis of his day. And he was also very high up at one time in the Tibetan hierarchy. This very, very great Tibetan Lama. And for various reasons, he moved to Kalimpong in northeastern India on the borders of Tibet. And he was living his life there, and he started to see these orphans, these Tibetan orphans, these children coming from Tibet, escaping the Chinese. He saw people begging on the streets, and he just decided that he had to do something. So he started an orphanage, a school, and just wonderful to see this great yogi and scholar and teacher who had a formidable spiritual practice. You know, just reading the stories of his Tibetan disciples saying how humble and ordinary he was in his giving. He just got down there and gave to people. There's a lovely book called Dada Rinpoche's Celebration, and the accounts of his Tibetan disciples are very, very moving in terms of seeing how a bodhisattva might just give in that very, very practical and tangible way. So we give to those in very obvious suffering. Fourthly, and this is interesting, we give to those who harm us. We give to our enemies. We give to those we are prone to disliking and hating. So you practice, you go the other way. You practice the wrong way. The right way, you know, going with the grain would be to kind of cut them off and not have anything to do with them. You go the wrong way and you give. You go out to them. And in traditional explanations of the Metta Bhavana practice, they say that if you're having a real problem in the fourth stage, you know, day after day, week after week, the recommendation is that you go and give that person a gift, something that they need or something that will delight them. You don't tell them, look, I hate you, I have problems in the fourth stage, so here's a gift. because it says in the books that you don't do that. No, you don't tell them anything. You haven't told them you dislike them, nothing like that. You just give them something. You do something very tangible to remove the obstruction. Again, there's a lovely story about Dada Rinpoche. It's interesting. He's sort of naturally risen up in talking about this. There was a man who regularly abused him in Kalimpong, who really took a dislike to him and hated him and did all sorts of things to undermine his work. And Dada Rinpoche never, ever reacted at all. And when this man died, Dada Rinpoche performed his funeral rites, which is a very big thing in among Tibetans. And people said, well, how can you, he hated you. And Dada Rinpoche said, well, he's in need. He needs my help now. And a wonderful example. So in fact, generally, if you're having difficulties with metta-bhavana, with any of the stages, actually with any meditation, come to that, but that particular one is worth mentioning, try being generous. If it's not with things, then give your time, give your energy, give courtesy, be helpful. Look at that whole side of your life. It's like generosity, it's generosity yoga. Dana yoga, we're used to the word yoga in meditation context or the physical context, but there's a generosity yoga. You put yourself into the asana, the position, the posture of generosity, so that the mood of generosity will begin to flow. I was talking to somebody in our community the other day, and they were talking about how good it was, living here, and they said one of the reasons why they liked it is that sometimes when they get in a bit of a sort of, down, bit kind of negative mood, there's always somebody to go and make a cup of tea for and see if they're okay. It's one of the great virtues of living in a little community village like Padmaloka. It's you can kind of go and do something like that. So the second broad area of giving is fearlessness. Gampopa doesn't say very much about this. He just says that you give fearlessness so that people aren't frightened of dangerous wild animals, robbers, and so on. So you get a picture from that of what the old Tibet was actually like, that people would be, very, very frightened by these kinds of things. So the Bodhisattva gives confidence and reassurance to people who are frightened by the dangers of life. And of course, this is still very important. Some people have very deep fears and anxieties, and it can be, paralysing for them. They can end up doing crazy things because of their fear. Well, this is still going on. It might not be sort of demons and, robbers and, wild animals and all the rest of it, but there are all sorts of things that are very, very frightening. So you give your confidence, your support, your reassurance to people. You stand by them shoulder to shoulder, and the vibration is not just the words, the vibration is it's okay. When I was thinking of this, somehow a memory of childhood came up, very strong memory. When I was very small, a child, I used to have a thing where I'd go to bed sometimes where I'd feel everything was going too fast. That was the only way I could describe it. It was as if everything was in a whirl, and it was very frightening. There's this sort of, everything was going too fast. And I always used to sleep with the door open, or I'd open the door of my little room when everything was going too fast. And my father and mother were in their bedroom, which was quite nearby. And if I was, my father would say, well, are you all right? Are you okay? And I'd say, everything's going too fast for me. And, it was a really desperate sort of state. And he'd just say, well, slow it down. And it's okay. I'm here. And I'd say, are you still there? And he'd say, yes, I'm here. And it was really so reassuring. And he didn't come in and try to make it go away. He was just there. It was a very deeply reassuring and comforting experience. Well, we have to be like that sometimes, not just with children. We have to be that with adults. We have to be that with one another, because sometimes the fragility of life and the dangers of life are so overwhelming. So we need to bring that tender strength into relation to people, to really impart confidence and fearlessness and give them strength. It's a wonderful thing if you can give this, if you can stand, you know, confidently on your ground, as it were, and give that to people. Third main area of generosity Gampopa mentions is giving the Dharma. And this is traditionally regarded as the highest gift, because you're giving people the means to liberation. And to do that, obviously, you need to be deeply in touch with the Dharma. You need to have studied the Dharma, practiced the Dharma, be studying it, be practicing it. And Gampopa talks about how thorough the teaching should be. He is talking very much in his context. He says the Dharma should be presented logically and not in a perverted way, according to the tradition. And you give with humility. It's very important in giving the Dharma, he says, that you're not thinking, well, this is this is me teaching. It's you passing on what you've learned. You're passing on the very little that you know. And Gampopa says you give the Dharma free from any materialistic consideration. You don't give the Dharma for payment. There's no such thing as a professional Buddhist teacher. If you are a professional Buddhist teacher, you're deeply missing the point. There's no such thing either as a teaching role. I think this is incredibly important. You share your knowledge and experience in a friendly way. And primarily, you're someone who practices the Dharma. And teaching, which is a word I don't particularly like, is simply sharing your practice, your understanding, so such as it is, with other people. And free from materialistic consideration means putting aside, if necessary, personal comforts, not minding any kind of hardship in order to give the Dharma. This is stressed very, very strongly in the Bodhisattva tradition, that you always respond to an invitation, and it doesn't matter how difficult the circumstances are. I remember once meeting an old disciple of Sangharakshita, a Buddhist politician, Mr. Rupa Watte, who told me stories about Bhante when he was in India, about Sangharakshita in the 1960s, when he took him to his area of Maharashtra named Ahmednagar, which is a very, very poor part of India, where the Buddhists there were extremely poor. And he said, with tears in his eyes, he was very moved recounting this, he said, we'd never seen a monk like Sangharakshita. Other monks would want all sorts of arrangements laid on, like cars and, you know, special food. But Sangharakshita just, well, he didn't mind what he ate, he didn't mind what he drank, he didn't mind where he slept. He didn't even mind, you know, being taken from one talk to another on the crossbar of somebody's bicycle. So yes, you go out of your way to communicate the Dharma. And your communication of the Dharma is tireless because you love it, you love doing it. At the same time, Gampopa says it should be appropriate. You don't communicate things that people aren't ready for and that they will misconstrue. You share your experience and your struggles if necessary. You share your efforts as well as your inspirations. And generally, the way you give, this applies to everything, all the areas of giving, Gampopa says, you give with devotion. You give courteously and respectfully. You know, sometimes when people give, they can make you feel small in some way, but you give with devotion. You give with courtesy and respect. And you give without regret. There's no regret. You're not thinking, oh, wish I hadn't given that CD away. No, you give without regret. It's gone. And it's also said you dedicate the merits of your giving to others. This is an interesting point. Traditionally in Buddhism, any skillful action, positive action, creates a very positive momentum in our being, and you dedicate that to that positive momentum to the enlightenment of all beings. So you even give away the positive momentum that you've gained. So you give away, as it were, your virtue. Gampopa says that generosity should be supported by wisdom and compassion. So you give compassionately to people, it should be supported by wisdom and compassion. And supporting it by wisdom means stamping your generosity with four seals. And the four seals are realizing the emptiness of yourself, the emptiness of the thing given, the emptiness of the mind and the objective situation, and the emptiness of reality itself. So you give everything, you really do give things, but without a sense of self and other and the thing given. I suppose you could say that in the end, this is natural generosity, the natural unforced flow of unself-conscious giving. So you're so in tune with the insubstantial, interconnected nature of life, you're not even thinking of giving. It looks as though you're giving. Other people look at you and think, oh, he gives a lot. But you are, as it were, in the music, in the dance, spontaneously enriching the world around you. And it's not just supported by wisdom, it's supported by compassion and love. You're doing this out of deep love and concern for others. So that's the perfection of generosity. And it's no wonder at this point Gampopa can quote a text which says, thus, when a bodhisattva has completed the perfection of generosity, he realizes the supreme and perfect enlightenment. Well, you might be thinking that's enough. It's enough that I practice the chaining in generosity to the point of perfection. But Gampopa says no. At first, our generosity will not be perfect. So we need also to train in sila, ethics. We need to perfect sila. Sila means conduct, behaviour, and it's usually translated as morality or ethics. Dr. Gunter translates this chapter, chapter 13 of Gampopa's book, which deals with the sila paramita, as the perfection of ethics and manners. The perfection of ethics and manners, which some of you might not like the sound of. So what's he actually getting at? What he's getting is that sila paramita is not simply a matter of training in the well-known Buddhist precepts of non-harm and so on. It also covers how you behave in the actual details of your life, how the great ethical principles and precepts translate into everyday behaviour, hence manners. And Gampopa certainly draws that out, and much else besides. Again, it's another very rich chapter, and again quite impossible to explore all of it. So it's again going to be the things that strike me. The first point that Gampopa makes is that lacking ethics, no matter how generous you are, you're like a blind man who cannot see forms, or someone without feet who can't walk. Without ethics, you won't see the Dharma, you won't see the way, and you won't be able to walk along that way. It seems to be saying something about the quality of intelligence in ethics. You're seeing the deeper implications of what you're doing, and you're behaving ethically. Your behaviour is aligning with the way things are. In the early stages of spiritual practice, generosity could be impulsive, it could be deluded, you could end up in some very tricky situations, and you might be coming from some very dodgy motives. You might even be, you know, taking the not given from some people and giving to others. Practicing ethics brings your values into play, brings your intelligence to bear. So Agampopa goes on to describe such things in his chapter on ethics as the essence of ethics, which means properly receiving the ethical training principles from a preceptor. In other words, you practice ethics in the context of spiritual community and spiritual friendship. Buddhist ethical precepts are very general. We need to apply them, and spiritual friends help you to do that, as well as being an example to you. And Gampopa also lists the different kinds of specifically bodhisattva ethics. He gives detailed lists of different things a bodhisattva doesn't do. And I'm going to give you a flavour of those by looking at what are called the four root, or the four fundamental fallings away from the bodhisattva path, the bodhicitta. Just to give you a little insight into the kind of ethics a bodhisattva practices. So the bodhisattva works on not praising himself and disparaging others. So the bodhisattva doesn't big himself up. He's not the great I am. And he puts others down. He doesn't do that. That is, of course, breaking his fundamental solidarity and connection with others. He doesn't either, the second downfall is, he doesn't withhold the wealth of the Dharma. He's not stingy with the Dharma. He gives it freely. He doesn't have what they call traditionally the tight fist of a bad teacher who holds things back. He wants to share. He's inspired by the Dharma. So he wants to share that with everybody. The bodhisattva doesn't, thirdly, punish and not accept an apology. So bodhisattva doesn't hold on to resentment and grudges, even subtly. He's always willing to accept apology. He doesn't need, really, apology, because he's forgiven the action, the offence already. So in a bodhisattva, there's no blame of others. He understands. He doesn't define himself by his hurts and slights, real or imagined. And he's eager to see and find the good in others. And he's very, very willing to forgive. Forgiveness, I think, is an incredibly mysterious and powerful act, and there is a deep wisdom in it. Fourthly, a bodhisattva doesn't pretend to follow the bodhisattva path, but in fact isn't really doing it. You can have all the language of caring and loving and generosity and forgiveness and enlightenment for all beings, but you're not really doing it. It's just the right words. Maybe it's the fashionable words of the day. You know, I hear you when you're not listening. What are your needs when you're not interested? And you put on that right face, that listening face. But it's not real. It's a sort of technique, or it's sentiment. It's very easy to do this, I think. Very easy to do it with religion. Very easy to do it with, well, it's not a religion, but with Buddhism. Buddhists are fantastic with words and describing great visions. I should know. But we need always to check, how real is it? How real is it? It can even apply to meditation. There's a story of a devout Buddhist in the East doing his, he'd have a daily metta-bhavana practice, very religious in his metta-bhavana practice, love for all beings flowing out. And every day his servant would come in, because he was a wealthy devout Buddhist, who would leave his tea on the table so that when he'd finished his metta-bhavana he could have his cup of tea. And one day the servant tripped as he came in and spilt the tea and made a noise and all the rest of it. And immediately the devout Buddhist doing the metta-bhavana jumped up and started to thrash his servant, shouting, "You fool, you're disturbing my metta-bhavana." So it's not real metta-bhavana. It's just sitting there having nice ideas about loving people. But I can remember similar things myself. I can think of a time in India in particular, where I was on the road doing a lot of, down in the coastal districts of Maharashtra state, and doing lots of talks, lots of Dharma teaching with a very dear friend of mine named Bodhi Sen, an Indian order member who was my interpreter, extraordinarily positive and cheerful kind, generous man in a very straightforward way. And, you know, these tours, you do a lot of talks in a very short space of time, and sometimes the bus wouldn't turn up, you know, it would be hours late. And I can remember one time I was getting really, really fed up. I was really getting fed up. I was tired. I was getting angry. I was getting really angry with being in India. And I started to sort of sulk and not talk properly to Bodhi Sen. I was sort of blaming him. I mean, he hadn't done the thing. And, you know, I was really like this. And then suddenly, you know, that sort of feeling, another kind of you kind of looks back at yourself and says, hang on, you know, what are you talking about in your lectures? You're going on and on about metta and patience and generosity and, you know, not getting into negative states. And look at you, look at what you're doing. It's just because a bus is late and you're a bit tired. You're cutting off from, you know, this man who is just so good to you, so kind to you. Well, you have to really watch out for that when you're on this path. So really watch out for self-delusion. So you can see that with these four downfalls, that a bodhisattva's ethics are really getting at our basic egotism and self-centeredness, even in these quite subtle ways, even in relation to you living a Buddhist life. Gampopa also gives another category of ethics, which looks at a bodhisattva's behaviour in body, speech and mind. And here we have wonderful descriptions of applied mindfulness and loving kindness. Gampopa speaks of avoiding silly behaviour, such as unnecessary running about and other forms of restlessness. I sometimes think that these particular teachings are particularly for young novices. You can imagine, you know, these young kids who've become monks early on, you know, unnecessary running about and other forms of restlessness, but I'm sure it applies to me equally. Instead, one aims to be, Gampopa says, restfully composed and to have a smiling countenance. And there's a beautiful quotation from Shantideva again. Thus, one should be one's own master and always show a smiling face without frowning. One should be genuinely friendly to everyone. And when you look at people, look straightforwardly at sentient beings. And in a loving way, thinking, it's because of them that I can attain enlightenment. So, what's being described here is a kindly, friendly, loving awareness. Sometimes mindfulness and awareness is presented as cold and rigid and disconnected. But in the Bodhisattva tradition, mindfulness includes awareness of people, of being considerate and friendly and even grateful, because without others, spiritual progress is impossible. Because spiritual progress is not possible without loving kindness. It's just not possible. And to have loving kindness, you have to have people. You have to have beings. He also speaks of mindfulness in relation to the body and its movements, and how you sit and lie down. And in another place, Gampopa doesn't mention this, but Shantideva does. He says that you should move like a cat or a thief. That's a wonderful description to get a feeling of mindfulness. Watch the way a cat very carefully and silently just pads along the ground. And a thief, you know, all that stealth, you know, to steal the money. So we should walk and move like that with great care and attention. Be very silent and soft, really tune up. And earlier Padmadaka talked about in the shrine room, you know, really trying to work on this aspect of things, being as silent as possible. And when you try entering and leaving the shrine room, especially looking at leaving, but entering too, really try to walk like the cat, walk like the thief. When you leave the shrine room, no one should notice. Grandpopa also mentions mindfulness in relation to things. You don't scrape chairs. You don't violently open and close doors. You don't aggressively march around. You fill your life instead with mindful presence, and there's great dignity and majesty in this. The second area of mindfulness is in relation to speech. Gampopa says don't talk much. If you talk too much, you just get involved in idle, useless, coarse and rigid speech. Keep silent. So we're going to have a bit more silence. That will help us. And especially we speak when we speak with great care, and especially avoiding harsh speech to others, not being offensive and rude, being considerate in speech. Thirdly, there's proper behaviour in mind, and this means not hankering after gain and honour, and not being addicted to dreaminess and sloth, and sorting out muddled thinking, developing a clear and alert mind, focused on what is important and meaningful. And obviously meditation is very important at this, but maintaining it throughout the day. So that's some highlights from The Perfection of Ethics. Through ethics, Gampopa says, we become a better person, of course. He says you become trusted by others. So you notice this, you know, people who are ethical, you really trust them. And you even become honoured by others. So, you know, if you want honour and, well, be very, very ethical. It's how you achieve, Gampopa says, a truly human state. But the perfection of ethics, which is what the Bodhisattva is concerned with, is that you don't settle down in what you achieve through your ethical practice. You sometimes see this in people coming along to Buddhism. They're all over the place. They take up meditation. They sort their life out with a bit of ethics. And then they get so far and then they leave. And then maybe you'll see them a few years later and their life has fallen apart again. It's because they've come to a halt at a particular state. So we use ethics as a support for even further, even greater spiritual development. So let's turn to the third great perfection. This is Kshanti Paramita, the perfection of patience or forbearance. And Gampopa explores this in chapter 14 of the Dual Ornament of Liberation. And he says at the beginning of the chapter, if an ethical man is impatient, he is roused to anger and loses in a moment whatever goodness he has acquired from previous generous behaviour. And he quotes an ancient Buddhist text that says a single burst of rage can destroy the positive effects of spiritual practice performed over many, many years. This sounds rather drastic, but there is truth in it, I think. When you lose your temper, when you express that, in a very short time, you can do so much damage. So much damage can be done, and it can take a very long time to sort that damage out. It this refers to the effects of habitual resentment just smouldering away, that habitual blaming of others just going on and on, that sense of, you know, you've been done over somewhere, somehow. And that just drains energy from any creative endeavour, from any spiritual life, and it needs to be dealt with. So it means that if we get into these things, that we don't have patience. Not just patience, I think this word forbearance is important. Letting go of feeling hard done by. Letting go of blame and resentment. Gampopa says, when one indulges in anger and hatred, the mind has no peace. It does not find joy and happiness, and one becomes sleepless and restless. In brief, there is no way you can be happy when you are angry. Gampopa also says that if you are an angry, resentful person, people will avoid you. It doesn't matter how generous you are, how learned you are. If you're prone to anger or resentment, people give you a wide berth. Of course they will. Nobody wants to be on the end of that. His friends get tired of him, and though he entices them by generosity, they do not stay. Sometimes, of course, life is very, very challenging. We're in circumstances, we're with people that are just very hard to bear, and there might be great, enormous provocation. We might not be able to avoid that sometimes, but the Buddha and the best Buddhist tradition is consistently clear. There is never, ever any justification for retaliation with anger, hatred or violence. It doesn't matter if they abuse you verbally or physically. It doesn't matter if they attack your cherished values. It doesn't matter if they destroy Buddhism. There is no justification at all for violent response. This is very, very challenging Dharma. This is the most radical teaching of the Buddha. It's not either encouraging weakness or meekness. It's not saying that you don't act with intelligence and wisdom to deal with these situations. But there is never any justification in returning insult with insult, blow with blow. And that's why Gampopa refers to the very famous saying of the Buddha, patience is the highest ascetic practice. In ancient India, some people were very into severe ascetic discipline, you know, really sort of putting themselves through it physically. And the Buddha said, well, you don't need to do all that. Patience, forbearance, kshanti, that's the best, that's the real, that's the highest asceticism. Denying yourself retaliation, bearing the hurt, not giving in to resentment, developing wisdom and love. This is very challenging Dharma. The essence of patience, Gampopa says, this is very interesting, is to be prepared for every event. Being prepared for every event, ready for anything. This is very significant. Often we get thrown when things don't turn out as we expected. The train's late, the person's late, the car breaks down, someone tells you off, someone's forgot something. Be prepared for that. Not in an anxious way, a worrying, controlling way, trying to sort of, you know, button down everybody. You know, don't become a control freak. You just have to be prepared for these things through cultivating a constant awareness of impermanence and unsatisfactoriness. These things happen in life. You also need to be ready for anything by cultivating love and compassion, so that too can be brought to bear at any moment. When things happen, when stuff goes down, when things break down in some way, when there's a crisis, you discover the real quality of your spiritual practice. How calm are you? How clear are you? How friendly are you? How patient are you? Patience depends on our training. So Gampopa mentions three main areas where we train in patience. In relation to people who harm us, secondly, the sufferings that are involved with life, and thirdly, patience in relation to reality itself. So first of all, patience in relation to people who harm us. And Gampopa gives a number of reflections on how to deal with this kind of situation. So it's how we deal with people who criticise us, attack us, now, or perhaps they did it in the past. I think it's also worth noting that we also need to bring this to in relation to people we don't like. They're not out to harm us. They just do things. They have manners that just irritate us. And maybe we're very prone to noticing their faults and get annoyed with them. The friendliness doesn't flow. So there are subtle areas to deal with. Perhaps we need to reflect on a saying of Dr. Samuel Johnson that I discovered recently. Kindness is within our power, even when fondness is not. Kindness is within our power, even when fondness is not. It's a wonderful saying. So some of the ways in which that Gampopa recommends to work on patience, they're reflections. So if someone is out to get you, or you're with a very awkward and tricky customer, it's easy to get irritated. So really work on developing understanding. Understand them. Understand that the person isn't really master of himself. He's under the sway of all sorts of habits and conditions. You might even reflect, well, if I'd had the kind of life that they had or they have, I would be just like them. Try to get some perspective on them. Try to get some understanding, and that will start undoing the irritation. Try to see as well, take it further, they're not a fixed entity. They're actually insubstantial, after all, as we are. They don't have, actually, a fixed and eternal soul. They're not actually just like this all the time. Try to see them more deeply. See that they're impermanent. Reflect that they'll die. That could happen to them at any time. And they don't want that. They want to live. So it's inappropriate to wish them harm, to wish them damage. You're contributing to their destruction. They too, like you, have a precious human existence. So connect with that. Connect with that in them. Whatever else might be going on. And then ask, well, what am I bringing to the situation here? This is put rather dramatically. Gampopa refers to a text which says, well, he might bring the stick to beat me, but I bring the body. Who's to blame in this situation? Well, that's a bit drastic, perhaps, but perhaps we could check when we're having difficulties with somebody, what am I bringing? What can I work on in this situation? Another reflection is gratitude. Difficult people out to get you, give you a wonderful opportunity to practice patience, an intensely strong loving kindness. In fact, they are our teachers. They are our gurus because they give us the great teaching of patience. They're our friends, actually, our best friends. They don't know that they are, but they are. Because you're having to do so much work, spiritual work, to develop patience and love without losing your sense of truth and dignity. So you can see from this that patience and love are well beyond likes and dislikes. They're qualities that transcend that. Kindness is within our power, even when fondness is not. And it's a very profound saying. Secondly, there's patience in relation to the sufferings involved with life. And what Gampopa means here is being patient in relation to all the hardships of leading the Bodhisattva's life that are involved in spiritual training. He understands that that can be very hard work. He mentioned such things as well. You know, you have to give things up, to give up your attachments. You have to engage in spiritual practices at times of the day when you'd rather be in bed, and you have to listen to really long talks on the Dharma. I mean, you think, you know, long and wearying, he says. By the way, mine are very short, by the way, in comparison to the tradition. They go on for days and days. Well, he understands it's all hard work. So bear it. Bear it. Just put up with it. Just keep engaging in the training. One thing I notice is that people give up too easily. People give up far too easily. You know, you decide on the retreat to go to all the meditation sessions. So you do this for a few days. Anyway, you decide to do it. And you have one meditation, two meditations that are a bit dull, a bit boring. Nothing seems to be going on. So you think, I won't go next time. As the bell goes, I'll stay in bed this morning. And then you start again, then you stop again, and then people wonder why they aren't making any progress. It's a bit like, you know, you're trying to boil water, and you put the gas on, and it starts to get warm, and then you turn it off. And you think, oh, that's weird, the water hasn't boiled. Don't give up too easily, stay with it. And then if you're on the Bodhisattva path, you're involved with others and you might be giving a lot. And that can, you know, be hard work sometimes. And people might not be interested in you. They just walk away. Oh, it's all right. It's just your trip. Or they don't like you. You know, you're being as pleasant as you can, but they just don't like the look of you. And they make that very clear. Or maybe you've given a lot and the person's really responded. And maybe, you know, you've really... You know, you seem to be developing a wonderful spiritual friendship and, you know, the thing's going really well, and then they just go away. They just give up Buddhism. The number of times I've seen likely people at a class who they're really up for it, you know, come to the course for 6 weeks. You know, they want in, never see them again. You have to bear that. You have to bear that. It's very painful. You have to bear it. And you learn, it's teaching you something, this kind of circumstance. There are many stories of this in the Buddhist tradition, of the teacher pouring things out and the disciple just walking away, just rejecting him. And he carries on. Very important, this. When it gets tough, there's a one we can get very faint-hearted and think, oh, there's something terribly wrong. Something wrong with my practice. Something wrong with Buddhism. So we've got this idea that Buddhist practice must always be smooth and easy and peaceful, and everyone nice and loved up, and lovely Buddhist centres are going to be rising up all over the place that are going to be thriving. It's just not like that at all. You have great moments, sure, inspirational moments, but it's work. It's hard work. And you have to dig in. So patience and forbearance are to do with developing grit and strength as well. There's great strength in patience. And this is just prefiguring the perfection of virya, or energy, which we'll look at on Monday. Thirdly, there's patience in relation to reality. And this is really the wisdom in patience. In the end, this is what we have to cultivate. Later on, Gampopa speaks of the highest patience of all, the perfection of patience, which is very mysterious. It's the patient acceptance of the unborn nature of all things. I won't try to take that idea on, but I want to say something about patience in relation to reality. And I'd like to talk about this in relation to forgiveness, just very briefly. When we're truly patient, when we have the wisdom of patience, we have true forgiveness. We can forgiveness because we have the wisdom of forgiveness. Forgiveness, yes, it does mean letting go of any desire of retaliation. It means responding with love and acceptance, whatever goes on. But in forgiveness, there is a very deep understanding, a very deep wisdom. Because in forgiveness, you're not just forgiving a person. You're forgiving life itself. It's about, as much as anything, a forgiveness of things. And all things are forgiven, for it would be strange not to forgive, says a character in Chekhov. And all things are forgiven, for it would be strange not to forgive. To forgive means that you deeply, profoundly understand and accept the impermanent, insubstantial and unsatisfactory nature of life. The leaves will fall from the trees, and the rose at its fullest blooming is already fading. And people do leave you. It is the way it is. So a bodhisattva is always in this state of forgiveness. He's always ready to forgive. He dwells always in this place of deep and profound acceptance. This is the perfection of patience.